Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome to Quality of Life. Central California's national parks are known worldwide for their incredible natural wonders, from giant sequoias to breathtaking waterfalls and towering granite monoliths. Last year, Yosemite National Park drew over 4 million visitors, nearly breaking the all-time record set in 1996. Sequoia and Kings Canyon drew over 1.6 million, with the Sequoia Park visits near an all-time high as well. But with those big crowds come big problems. Traffic jams, accidents, noise, and pollution are all issues, and park managers are faced with the challenge of balancing conservation with public access. Public access of a different sort is also an issue for California's state parks. Later in our program, we'll look at how those parks are faring in this age of the perennial budget crisis in Sacramento. The governor recently announced a plan to close 70 state parks, including several in Central California. We'll find out what solutions may exist to keep those parks open, and we'll ask you, should funding of state parks be a higher priority for Sacramento lawmakers? That's coming up in a little bit, so stay tuned. But right now, though, we're talking about the issues facing our national parks, and we'd like to know what you think. What's the best way to balance the often competing interests of public access and conservation? Do you have visits to the parks planned for this summer, or do the big crowds keep you away? Here to kick off our discussion, we're joined in studio by John Rasmussen of the Tehipite chapter of the Sierra Club. And on the phone, we have Ron Sundergill, a Pacific Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association. First of all, John, welcome to our program today.
Thank you.
And again, Ron, thank you also for joining us on the phone today.
Good to be here.
Gentlemen, I want to start out in talking about the mission of the national parks. Back in 1916, when President Wilson created the National Park Service, he said, the goal is to conserve the scenery and natural and historic objects and wildlife therein, and to provide for the enjoyment of the same in such manner and by such means as we will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. How are we doing in living up to that goal set back in 1916? And John, I'll start with you.
I don't think we're really living up to the exact goal of unimpaired. We continually change to meet the goals of the current generation. Back in when the parks were first created, there was heavy discussions on whether the automobile should be allowed at all. And now we talk continually about how much automobile access should be allowed. We have a wilderness plan for Sequoia and Kings Canyon parks coming up, where access also becomes an issue for our wilderness. New technology. Do we allow cell phones in wilderness?
Those are all very interesting issues that they probably couldn't have foreseen back in 1916. But as times change, those become issues for debate and discussion, and we certainly will hear about that today. Ron, I'd like to hear your thoughts. Are we living up to that original mandate today? How are we doing in terms of preserving these treasures for future generations?
Well, let's take Yosemite as an example, which is not too far from your station. Back in, like, I'll use 1914 as a baseline number here. 1914, the number of visitors to Yosemite was 15,154 people. Today, that number is close to 4 million per year. You know, with that kind of visitation, you know, there are bound to be impacts, and you know, parks like Yosemite that are very popular, and certainly Yosemite is the most popular in California. You know, the managers of those parks have a significant challenge on their hands, and I think they're doing really well for the amount of people that are going to Yosemite and other parks. I think the the National Park Service does a really good job of managing the resources, but it is challenging. And, you know, Yosemite right now is going through some significant planning processes to figure out how they can do a better job of managing the resources and dealing with the people that love it so much.
In doing some research for this program, I was interested to know the amount of total visitors the national parks receive on an annual basis, and I was absolutely astounded. 281 million recreational visits in 2010. To some extent, are the national parks victim of their own success? That's quite an astounding number, considering I think the latest population estimates for the country are around 309 million. How are we doing nationwide beyond just Yosemite? National parks are obviously being used by the public in a great way. Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
I think that it's really important that people get out and experience nature and that they experience our national parks. I think it is one way that people develop an appreciation for the environment. You know, as a conservation organization, we want people to experience our parks, and we would rather not, set up some sort of a system that would limit who gets into the parks or how many people get into the parks. We prefer instead to make sure that the parks are managed well, and that those visitors, when they come, are not impacting the park. And as I said, that is hard to do, but it is being done, and I think the Park Service is doing a pretty good job of managing those visitors and making sure that the resources are preserved for future generations. Not saying that there aren't some problems. There always are challenges, but I think it's a good thing that there's so many people that are interested in getting out and enjoying nature and seeing some of our crown jewels.
And we'll talk about some of those specific things in just a moment, and also want to bring up the issue of budgets and all of those issues that are continually having an impact on these things. But turning back to our discussion and specifically to Yosemite, one issue that's been in the news, and it came up earlier this spring, climbing Half Dome has become a very popular activity, and so popular as in recent years there have been some accidents and other safety issues in climbing Half Dome. And this year the National Park Service for the first time has instituted a program requiring permits for climbing Half Dome at any time that the rails are up on the mountain. And those permits offered earlier this year sold out in just a matter of minutes. And they were sold for, I think, just about $1.50. It was a nominal charge. Then you all of a sudden starting to pop up on eBay, Craigslist, other sites, people beginning to sell and exchange these permits to hike Half Dome. What are the challenges in trying to take something that's so popular and trying to make sure that it's both safe for the people who want to experience it and also preserving the resource that people are going to see? And John, I'll let you start with that one.
This is an interesting one because it's not only hiking up the back of Half Dome. Just recently, there's been significant discussion about climbing up the front of Half Dome also. So, we have groups of people that are climbing up the front of Half Dome, unroped, enjoying a completely different experience than the people coming up the backside. Access to both of them should be available. The challenge is, you know, when you have a resource that becomes limited, and the Park Service attempted to fix a problem that was beyond the expectations of what those cables can handle up there. If you've ever been on the back of Half Dome, passing 100 people on a cable where if you let go, you're likely to die, is a safety issue that the park had to address. Now, they came up with a permit system. What they found out is their permit system didn't work. They have to go back to the drawing board and come up with a valid permit system. And that's always a challenge. Do you create a, you know, do you do it to the highest bidder? Well, that doesn't seem right for a national park. So how do you manage it? Is it a first come, first serve? You get your permit when you get up there. That's another option. What the Park Service needs to do is work with the public and come up with a plan that the public can support.
You just joined us on Quality of Life today. We're talking about our national parks and the matter of balancing conservation and access and all of the various elements therein. We're joined in our studio today by John Rasmussen of the Tehipity Chapter of the Sierra Club, and on the phone by Ron Sundergill. He's the Pacific Senior Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association. And as always on our program, we'd like to know what you think. How do you best balance these competing issues? Over 4 million people visit Yosemite every year. They bring with them a lot of problems. How do you protect the environment and allow public access? The phone number you can call with your comments and thoughts, 559-275-8989, or toll-free 800-224-8989. You can also email us at talk@kvpr.org. Yosemite is one of California's crown jewels, and 4 million people come to see it every year. At some point, though, those crowds keep people away and degrade the experience to some extent. No one wants to leave the city and the traffic jams of the city only to be stuck in a traffic jam in Yosemite Valley. John, what are your organization, from the Sierra Club's perspective, what's your thoughts on how best to provide access to the park?
Even within our organization, it becomes controversial because, you know, how do you provide access for hikers, backpackers, day use users versus still keeping that natural experience that everybody wants? And I think within our organization, we've really come to the conclusion that the only way to really do it is to limit the total numbers of people that can get in at one time to certain areas. And by doing that, people may have to at times go to different areas. There's a lot of areas within Yosemite that are not at all crowded. You can go to places in Yosemite where you won't see a single solitary soul. Even within Yosemite Valley, there are places if you get out of your car and walk, you can go. There's places in Yosemite Valley that used to be very crowded that no longer are because the Park Service no longer puts a sign up saying that this is the place to go. And some of those places are very scenic and very spectacular.
On the surface, though, I can imagine that's a rather controversial suggestion that we should limit access of the public to a public resource, a national park. What type of reaction has that received thus far?
Oh, that always receives reactions from a lot of sources, especially people from chambers of commerce and motels. They want to be able to make sure that their clientele has first access. And unluckily, around Yosemite, this massive industry has built up to the point where when Yosemite's resources get restricted, their bottom line gets restricted. And again, it's another challenge between different users. There's other restriction sorts of issues too. Camping is a big restriction. For some people in the Central Valley, the Park Service has failed at providing access. We have campgrounds in Yosemite Valley that all of them have campfires. And you look at people in the Central Valley, how many have asthma? My wife can't camp in Yosemite Valley because she gets migraines from campground smoke. So there's other forms of access that are being prevented also.
Let's go to the phones now and take a call from Russell in Tehachapi. You're on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to call. I actually was lucky enough to grow up as a child outside of Yosemite and see a lot of the positive impact that it did bring to our local economy. And with the numbers that you were reporting of people visiting, you know, annually, to me, I think it would be a no-brainer to expand the parks and bring in more revenue and also kind of dilute the impact that we have on nature in one specific area. And, you know, the parks also preserve a lot of species and do a lot of scientific research. And I feel like we kind of take them for granted, and it's a shame that they're even on the chopping block at this point.
Russell, thank you very much for that call. And let me turn that question right around now to our guest again. John, your thoughts on that?
Problem with expanding it, there is a lot of area out there, and I'd be glad to have parks expanded in some spots. The big issue is not so much that there isn't a spot for people to go, is that everybody wants to go to the same place. We need to make it so that some other places are more accessible, and also make it so people understand that those places can be just as good to go to for a picnic as Yosemite Valley.
Again, we're talking about national parks on Quality of Life today, and should access to certain areas in Yosemite be restricted? Numbers are really high in visitors these years, and we'd like to know what you think. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. And I want to turn back to our guest, Ron Sundergill, from the National Parks Conservation Association. Are you seeing across the board in the national parks similar increases in attendance, and is that attributed in large part due to the economy, people going to national parks that may be closer to them rather than taking a longer trip to some more exotic locale?
You know, it's a mixed across the United States. There is a trend of a bit of an increase in the visitation of the national parks over the last couple of years, but it's not consistent across the board. There's been a bit of an uptick in Yosemite visitation in the last couple of years, but it's actually down from the 90s in comparison, so at Yosemite. By the way, you mentioned the potential expansion of parks in order to deal with the interest that people have in them, and that's one of the things that we are working on, is potential expansion of a number of our national parks. Haven't really done too much work with Yosemite, but there is a possibility of even expansion of Yosemite National Park in the future. Mm-hmm. We've been concentrating more on some of the other parks in the state, like Death Valley, Joshua Tree, Mojave Preserve. But that's one thing that we would like to see is not only expansions of parks, national parks, but actually looking at some new national parks, and you know, giving people more places to explore.
Let's go to the phones now and talk to Dennis in Bakersfield. You're on Quality of Life.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say one of the ways we get to experience the national parks at the southern end of the valley is their policy of being the biggest violator of air quality rules, burning without permits and stuff like that. Last year, we had a week of 100 air quality index of 190, and assuming, you know, over 70 and 80, it's unhealthful, but it was when they were doing their burning at up on the Kings River, and they refused to put it out, and they kept going because they told some of the state politicians to stop it, because I complained to them. And I think there is a point we get to do it, because the people who end up with the results are probably not exactly national park types. You know, they're probably of a, you know, there's some wildlife is a little bit better than other wildlife, as well as there's probably some people are probably a little bit more appropriate to, they feel are more appropriate to state to existence than others. I see it as an environmental justice issue.
Well, Dennis, thank you very much for that call, and appreciate your perspectives on our program today. And we are talking about the national parks here on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. And we'd like to know what you think. The phone number is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. And I should say, we did invite guests from the National Park Service to be a part of our program today, but they were not able to make it to our program. Before we go to break, Ron, I just want to address, actually, excuse me, John, I want to just bring that question to your attention, the issue of fire management in the national parks. That's a hot issue, and the Park Service over the past 50 years has changed its policies on controlling fires in national parks, but what about the impacts to residents outside of the parks?
It's a challenging issue because the Central Valley has increased in population and it affects a lot of people. The problem is the Park Service is really attempting to reduce the smoke from the that happens in the Central Valley by adjusting the timing, and they do put out parts of the fire and adjust it. If you don't do this, what eventually happens, and if you've lived in the Central Valley long enough, you will know that there's massive fires that will produce even more smoke. So the controlled burning and the management of the wildfire by the Park Service really in the long run ends up reducing the smoke, even though at times it's really bad. It's just that that's how forests work. There will be fires.
Again, we're talking about national parks on Quality of Life today, and we'd like to know your thoughts. Do the crowds keep you away from the national parks? And how best to strike the balance between preservation and access? You can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll free 800-224-8989. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio, and we're talking about the national parks and the opportunities and challenges they face with rising crowds. Yosemite nearly broke a record of over 4 million in attendance in 2010, and attendance this year certainly looks like it is going on a good clip as well. We're joined in our studio today by John Rasmussen of the Tehipity Chapter of the Sierra Club, and on the phone by Ron Sundergill, the Pacific Senior Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association. And let's go to the phones now and talk to Barney in Bakersfield. Barney, you're on Quality of Life.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the program.
Oh, thank you, thank you. I'd just like to say that, it's about quite a few years. Back in the 70s, I used to go up to Yosemite a lot, do a lot of rock climbing, but the clouds got really, really heavy, especially in some routes, and you were stacked up on top of one another, and we stopped going, and I hate to tell you where I am going now, but I want to keep that so other folks don't go. But I think there needs to be a balance. You know, you need to have access, but at the same time, you can't have everybody. I mean, everybody cannot go up the front side of Half Dome or even the back side, you know. Otherwise, there'd be a freeway up in the back. So there has to be some limit on the numbers of people. And so it's more of a balance. It's got to be a balance.
Well, Barney, thank you very much for that call on our program today. Talking about that balance, that's something we're hearing from a lot of individuals looking to see how we can strike that correct balance between nature and access. I guess it's almost like that line from Yogi Berra where he said that restaurant's so busy no one goes there anymore. But crowds can keep people away, and they can keep people from experiencing what they are there to experience, nature in all of its beauty, and not the sorts of things from the city, the traffic jams and pollution that they're seeking to get away from. Turning to our guest, John, from the Sierra Club, one of the things that's come up again is vehicular access to the park. 1997, the park has this management plan, and it talks about a long-term goal of being removing private vehicles from the valley. Is that something that is still on track, and what does your organization think about that?
I'm not sure if it's really on track or if anybody's really figured out a way to make it practically work. There's an attempt to restrict the amount of vehicles in Yosemite and restrict the impacts that those vehicles cause. But I think there's become a realization that removing all of the vehicles is not really completely practical. And I'm not sure if anybody's come up with a good solution at this point. That's why I think we are going back a little bit to the point where you can only really support so many people in the valley. My opinion, a lot of times, I'm also a rock climber and I've been up on the walls trying to experience the wilderness. Many people don't know. You get 400 feet up above the valley floor and you're in wilderness. And you're really not. You look down from your wilderness perch on the rocks and you see Winnebagos, big buses. The noise from buses is probably worse than most of the cars. I think the real goal is to reduce that city atmosphere more so than actually reducing the number of cars. Get the cars in there, get them parked, get people out of their cars.
Let's go to the phones now and talk to John from Madera. You're on Quality of Life.
Hello there.
Yes, John, you're on the air.
Yeah. My son tried to get reservations for a camp in Tuolumne Meadows this spring. Following the instructions, wait until 7 o'clock on a certain morning, several weeks ago, and call. And they started calling, and finally got through. Every reservation was taken. I read later or heard later that however, using computers, some people managed to grab all of those and that they are now, you know, showing up, as you mentioned, on trying to sell them.
And that was, do you have other plans? Does your son have other plans for a backup location?
He couldn't find anything in the Yosemite. They were all taken.
And what do you think would be a better way to handle that?
Well, they have to somehow really get to the first come, first serve instead of that. He ended up finding a place over in Big Basin by Santa Cruz, and that's where they're going to be. And we were planning on joining them up there. We've been up there. I live 2 hour or hour and a half from the south entrance of Yosemite, and we go up there regularly. In fact, next Monday is my birthday. We plan on going up there. And having a good trip, but that's an in-and-out trip. But trying to find any reservations there for camping were impossible following the system that they had.
Well, John, thank you very much for that call on our program today. We appreciate your comments. And before we have to move on to our next segment being the state parks, I want to turn back to Ron Sundergill, our guest from the National Parks Conservation Association, and talk about National Parks budget. Budget is the big issue, state, national. It's something that drives so much of the conversation these days. How is the National Park Service faring right now in the overall budget battle in Washington?
Well, we have experienced some cutbacks in this fiscal year, which is unfortunate because the parks are underfunded in a major way. So we're fighting to get that budget number back up in the next fiscal year, but it's going to be really tough. But in comparison to some of the other agencies, the National Park Service is doing well. The government, the leaders in Washington decided to cut, for instance, EPA back in a very significant way, whereas the National Park Service, got minor cuts. So, it's it's unfortunate, but we're going to keep fighting, and we'll work to make sure that the basic needs are taken care of, but ultimately, more money needs to go into the parks.
Let's go ahead and take one more call now. Jim from Toll House, you're on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Yeah, good morning. I have maybe a contrarian comment.
Go right ahead.
The the thing that impressed me was that the original mandate in 1916 was to preserve the environment for the enjoyment of people. I don't necessarily think that being able to climb El Capitan or Half Dome really preserves the environment, and I don't really think it's necessary to have to climb a rock in a national park to enjoy either rock climbing or the park itself. So I'm wondering if maybe people have been put before the national the natural resources, and the natural resources are being slowly expended. It reminds me of a petrified forest in the Southwest, where people were taking pieces of petrified wood, and you know, that became a violation. And because enough people take the petrified wood, there is no more petrified forest. So it seems like climbing rocks and doing the firefall that used to be isn't anymore, because that really doesn't preserve the natural resources. And I think people can enjoy it without having to destroy it. I'll take my comment off the air.
Well, thank you very much for that call, Jim, and I'll turn to John. The management strategies of the Park Service have changed quite a bit over the years. You mentioned the firefall, which was something that was very popular in many Valley residents for years, but that has gone away as attitudes have changed and conservation strategies have evolved. How are we in terms of evolving the mindset of management and conservation in the Park Service from your perspective?
You know, I think the parks were made and created not only to enjoy the scenery, but also to experience them. When you just look but don't touch, you really don't understand what the parks are about. When you actually get out there and touch the rocks and you find flakes and experience the different types of granite, you really begin to understand the parks much differently than if you just do a Disneyland ride sort of thing in a locked-down car. You really need to get out. You need to feel it. I'm also a caver. You know, you've got to go down into the depths to find that very scenic spot. It's not rock climbing, caving, kayaking. It's not just about the adventure. It's experiencing and learning. You go kayaking, you learn how the river flows, you learn the waves, you learn what it's like to be near death when you're gasping for that air and hoping that you get back up to the surface. What I think the country needs is more people getting out there and experiencing adventure in the wild, because that's what our tradition was about. And that's why we need to preserve these parks and wilderness areas.
Let's go back to the phones now and talk to David in Tehachapi. You're on Quality of Life.
Gentlemen, very nice to hear your voices this morning.
Yes, and your comment.
Well, my comment is basically, you know, I'm Clem Whitney. I'm an avid outdoor person. Tehachapi, as you know, is in the mountain community. And I don't understand why we can't have a lottery system for people to get into the park and limit it in that way. There's so many other places that people can go, whether it's the Golden Dome Wilderness Area, those sorts of places, or the National Sequoia National Forest, for that matter, that's not a national park, obviously, that people can go and enjoy, that we need to maybe spread the love a little bit. I think when you have somebody like Oprah Winfrey or someone like that that goes in Yosemite, that's what drives these things up. If we had a lottery, it would take care of these things, and we could and still have it open to people. If you raise prices, let's say, to get in, the people that need to come out that have a lower income wouldn't afford to. But a lottery, I think, is the fairest way to do it.
Well, again, David, thank you very much for that call, and we appreciate your comment today. And everyone who's called in, thank you so much for your calls and comments about the national parks. This is certainly a discussion that will continue. We've been joined on the telephone today by Ron Sundergill, the Pacific Senior Regional Director of the National Parks Conservation Association, also in studio by John Rasmussen of the Tehachapi Chapter of the Sierra Club, talking about national parks. We're going to change gears in just a moment and come back and talk about state parks and the future of the California state park system. It is currently in doubt as the governor announced plans to close over 70 parks coming up in the current budget crisis. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about the future of state parks on Quality of Life.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Earlier this month, California Governor Jerry Brown announced a proposal to close 70 of the state's 278 state parks in order to save some $11 million and help close the state's budget gap, which currently is estimated at $9.6 billion. The park closures impact all areas of the state and range from the Salton Sea to the governor's mansion in Sacramento. Of special interest to Valley Public Radio listeners, the closures include the Tule Elk State Natural Reserve and the Fort Tejon State Historic Park in Kern County, as well as the Mariposa Mining and Mineral Museum in Mariposa County. This isn't the first time that state parks have been on the brink. 2 years ago, Governor Schwarzenegger proposed closing 220 state parks, a proposal that ultimately did not take effect. Last November, California voters rejected Proposition 21, which would have instituted a vehicle license fee increase of $18 per vehicle, raising around $500 million a year in dedicated funding for state parks. Supporters said it was necessary to ensure a sound future for the state's parks. Opponents called it a prime example of the state's so-called ballot box budgeting. Voters said no, 58.9% to 41.9% saying yes. Here to talk about state parks, we have a couple of guests on the phone. Joining us right now on the telephone, we have Kathy Weatherman, the superintendent of the Tehachapi District of the California State Parks Department. Kathy, welcome to our program today.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. And we also have Jerry Emery, the communications director for the California State Parks Foundation. Jerry, thanks for taking the time to join us and talk about these issues today.
Well, thank you.
We'll talk about what some of the strategies are in dealing with this budget crisis and solutions perhaps to help keep some of these parks that are scheduled to close open. I want to start with Kathy, though, and tell our listeners a little more about the parks in your area and that may be scheduled to close. Are you there, Kathy?
Sure, I can do that. Currently, in the Tehachapi District, I manage 11 parks. Mostly what you would be concerned about is the Central Valley. I operate Colonel Allendore State Historical Park, and as you said, Tule Elk State Natural Reserve, and Fort Tejon State Historical Park. And then I manage in the Antelope Valley, the Antelope Valley Indian Museum, which is slated to close, Saddleback Butte, Tomokani State Historical Park, Arthur B. Ripley, and then I go all the way up to Silverwood Lake State Recreation Area, and then as far up to Needles at Providence Mountains, Mitchell Caverns.
Now, this isn't the first time that California state parks have been under the budget acts. I imagine this has to be, though, difficult for the staff of the parks and those who frequent these resources throughout our state in terms of morale and going on doing what you do so well. What's the overall state of morale in our parks right now that you manage?
Sure. Me personally, I've been with the department for 24 years, and what you find out with the employees that work for state parks, they're very passionate about their job. It's not just a paycheck. A lot of these places have historic, significant history. We have interpretive education. We have living history programs, and everybody just is, nobody knows what to do. And everybody, like I say, is so passionate about their job. But I tell them, guess what? We just take one day at a time. We just got to keep moving forward.
Jerry, turning to you, your thoughts on the overall future of state parks. This has been a continual budget battle over the years and over the administrations. California state parks seem to be one of those areas that often falls under the budget acts. You tried was sponsoring Proposition 21 last November. That didn't pass muster with voters. What are you hearing from constituents and people out there who use state parks in trying to find some sort of solution to these challenges?
Yeah, Prop 21 is looking pretty good right now, isn't it? Kind of in hindsight, if it had passed. Well, first of all, I want to say that, you know, people, the staffers like Kathy, who she says she's been here 24 years, so they do an amazing job with what they're given. And that's true throughout the system, being able to keep open the parks they have and give the service they do. I think that I don't have the exact figures in front of me. Maybe Kathy can correct me, but I remember hearing the director saying that there's right now, I think there's 500 openings for staff at DPR, which is the Department of Parks and Recreation. They're not going to be filled, and in fact, the staffing right now is something like at 1979 levels. So you have a staff at 1979 levels, and yet visitation has gone up and up and up until just recently, basically averaging around 70 million visitors a year to the California State Park System. So the staff have done a fantastic job, and we fully recognize that, and I hope that all Californians and visitors from around the world recognize that. So having given kudos to the staff, which is heartfelt on the part of the foundation, you know, we're hearing a lot from our members, obviously, and from non-members, just, parkies, people that love going to state parks. And they're looking for answers. They want something to be able to do. And that's one thing we can do because we're a nonprofit. We have an advocacy arm and we're quite active in Sacramento and we're looking for solutions. Right now the first action we took was to have people be able to send letters to their representatives and to the governor, opposing the closures. But I have to admit, and we admit, that this is different than the previous two times when there was a 48 state park closure threat and the 220, because the economy has just gotten worse and worse, and the budget is so gigantic that we're looking at a $22 million cut to state parks over the next 2 years. And that there might have been a little bit of posturing in the previous two proposals to close state parks and some politics, but this time around, we're basically, as is the state, thinking this is the real deal. So in order to try to be proactive and actually positive, we have some programs on the ground, a volunteer program we started up last year called the Park Champions Program to allow volunteers to work with state park employees in states, in state parks, to help with basic maintenance and other projects. We have a variety of things we do hand-in-hand with the state because we can raise money. We work on a lot of restoration projects hand-in-hand with the state. That's not keeping state parks open. And then also we've been pushing along Assembly Bill 42, which is being sponsored by Jared Huffman in Marin County. And that just passed the Assembly 4 floor, and it's basically on its way to the Senate and has to go through a couple committees, and it hopefully will be heard sometime in June before the Senate. And what AB 42 does, and this is a little bit longer term, is it allows the state parks to enter into cooperating agreements or management agreements with nonprofits. There's already it allows them to do it more readily. Right now, if they have a relationship with a nonprofit, it usually has had to go through specific legislation, which is very time-consuming and cumbersome. And so right now, you know, state parks, they have agreements with concessionaires, which are quite good for the most part throughout the state park system. So they have the ability to enter into agreements with for-profit organizations, and we're just trying to make it easier for state parks to enter into these agreements so that, I mean, it's not going to keep 70 state parks open, but it might help keep some of them open so that some of those resources can be diverted to other parks. And right now there's over 80 cooperating organizations with state parks, and they're all part of an organization called CALPA, which is the California League of Park Associations. And these range from anywhere from, you know, a small mom-and-pa shop that are friends of Park X, up to us, who's a fairly large nonprofit that works on behalf of state parks. And along that continuum, there are all sorts of organizations that run, you know, visitor centers in state parks. Maybe they do interpretive programs, and we're exploring ideas to really ratchet that up.
We're talking about the future of California's state parks on Quality of Life today, and let us know what you think. You can chime in right now by calling us at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. Our guests on the program today, in studio, we have John Rasmussen of the Sierra Club Tehipity Chapter. We also have on the telephone joining us from Sacramento, Jerry Emery. He's the Communications Director for the California State Parks Foundation, which is working to try to come up with some solutions to keep some of these state parks open of the 70 that are scheduled to close per the governor's mandate. And Kathy Weatherman, the superintendent of the Tehachapi District of the California State Parks Department, who supervises both the Tule Elk Reserve and the Fort Tejon State Historic Park, which would both close under the governor's plan. One of the things that's come up recently in the media has been the cost of closure. This is something that is not necessarily just lock the door and leave. California state parks include many state beaches and other areas that are accessible to the public otherwise. There's certain laws for access, and there's certain costs that the state would still incur. Kathy, from your perspective, what are you looking at in terms of the costs of closing the parks, besides the cost to the community and our quality of life and losing these resources? Is there a hidden cost, perhaps, in this proposal that isn't reflected in the bottom line?
Well, that's a very good point, because I don't think, as a department, we have thought through that full process yet. So the first process was defining what parks of significance can be closed, and they base that based on attendance and how much it costs to run a park. Now, the next step is, once the 70-park closure was approved, then we're going to go back to the table to see just how feasible it is to close some of these parks. Because, for example, I have a 27,000-acre park. There's no way that you can fence that and lock that up. There's no way. So there is going to be some cost. There are some discussions about maybe having a caretaker status where we have an employee that just lives there just to pretty much make sure there's no vandalism and nothing happens to the structures itself. Or there's been discussions about we just, lock the gate and we walk away, and then we just check on it every now and then. But we're also looking at some partnerships to see, like Jerry was saying, partnerships to see if we don't have to go to that extreme. So the department does realize that there will be some cost to closing a park, and so they're looking at that to see, feasibility, what's the best.
I'm turning to our studio guest, John Rasmussen from the Sierra Club. What does your organization think about this proposed closure of many of these state parks? Some of them are historic sites, but some of them are natural preserves. The Henry Coe State Park is scheduled to close, the Tule Elk Reserve, some great natural resources there as well.
Well, the big challenge is every time you close a park, it puts even greater pressure on another park somewhere. The state parks that are open are going to start receiving more visitors. How are you going to handle those additional visitors? There are some places that don't get very much use, that really don't have much staff either, or very much expense that can be improved by closing. You have one or two people at a park that's managing that park. You close it. What money do you save? You still have to have somebody guarding the park. It's a state resource. What are you going to do? Let the vandals come in and steal everything? The costs are still there.
It's a very good point. And Kathy, give us an idea for those of our listeners who perhaps have not been to either the Tule Elk Reserve or Fort Tejon. We're talking about closing these parks. What are we looking at in terms of layoffs, in terms of the things you'd have to go through to close these parks?
Right. And for example, Fort Tejon State Historical Park is obviously it's right off the I-5, the Grapevine. So there's no way that we could physically put a gate around that and close it. But the historical structures are there. And also it is a thriving living history program where we have school groups come out and actually stay the night. They wear the soldier outfit. They cook out in the open. They churn butter. They spend the night. They do drills just like the soldiers did in the 1800s. And to give up that resource is just heartbreaking. And again, I have staff there. There's about four employees that work there. They are so passionate about what they do and what they believe in and the history and the storytelling that they tell to the public and to our school children. It's, I look back and we know that this is all going to start effective July 1, 2012, when the actual closure happens. So we do have time to maybe move staff or put them in another park, or this is where our people and our partnerships come in and say, we're not going to stand for this closure. This is too important to the history of California and to the people of California. So we need to make that keep that open.
Let's turn back to Jerry Emery from the California State Parks Foundation. In looking at the budget cuts to state parks, this is not something new. In fact, the state park system has had severe cuts in the past few years. Over the past 2 years, over 60 parks have had partial closures and severe reductions at 90 others. What are we looking at in terms of where we're at today? It's not as if we're talking about making cuts from a budget that's already at record high levels.
No, and in fact, I have a little chart in front of me here that I got from DPR, which shows that the general fund allocation to state parks has decreased from 2006-07 level of $175 million to a projected $99. So state parks have been slowly taking a hit over the years. So we're looking at accumulated impact here. But the 150 parks you just mentioned that are experiencing either partial closures, which means sometimes like Monday through Friday, or maybe closing a camp loop, and then service reductions, which just means less trash pickup, maybe close a bathroom out of two. Those are going to continue. And Kathy mentioned July 1, 2012. This fall is when DPR is going to begin to kind of ramp up to figure out how to close state parks. Because you got to remember, because Kathy, it's quite clear listening to Kathy, you know, state parks is not in the business of closing parks. Right, I mean, it's kind of all. This is all new territory, so they're trying to have to figure it out park by park, and so that's the present situation. That the 150 being impacted are going to continue. Closures aren't happening until July 1. We're hoping that it gives us sufficient time to work on some creative partnerships, both at the corporate and in the private area, with DPR. I mean, the director Ruth Coleman has said, "Listen, if you got a great idea, bring it on." Basically. She's been a great partner with us trying to figure out and strategize around some of these things. But, you know, one thing that's going to happen is that because State Parks has been operating underneath reduced budgets and reduced personnel for years, there's a little known, and it's not really a sexy term, but there's a deferred maintenance issue out there across California's 278 state parks that adds up to $1.2 billion with a B dollars. And that means everything from, you know, septic systems that need to be upgraded, roofs that need to be patched, trail maintenance, I mean, you name it, everything you can imagine what maintenance entails across 278 state parks, historic buildings, wilderness areas, you name it. And I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure out that if you close state parks for multiple years, that deferred maintenance issue is only going to skyrocket. And there's all sorts of other, you know, we can get into a whole series of concerns about what happens in a state park, everything from just illegal activities to increased, you know, fire hazard, if that kind of maintenance isn't going on. There's all sorts of questions out there that hopefully we can collectively figure out along the way.
Again, we're talking about the future of California's state parks on Quality of Life today. You can let us know your thoughts. Should the future of the state parks be a higher priority for Sacramento lawmakers, or is the state's park system just too big for the state to handle in this new era of economic frugalness? You can call us with your comments, 559-275-8989, or toll-free 800-224-8989. There's another side to this story, though, and that's the economic engine that the economic activity that state parks generate every year, tourism, heritage tourism, those sorts of things. Jerry, what are we looking at in terms of the contribution that state parks make to the state's economy overall?
Well, first of all, Kathy mentioned about school kids. It's important to also realize that the California State Park System is the second most important educator of California's school kids. They have an amazing array of programs. She mentioned the history programs there. all throughout the state, and so that's going to have a ripple effect to local schools. But studies have been done to show that there's a spin-off kind of economic benefit to state parks and local economies, especially smaller rural places that you might pass through on the way to a state park. And so there's a repeating impact in the sense that not only are people paying to get into the state park, but maybe they have to stop at the store. They got to get gas. You got to get stuff for your cooler. They forgot ice. They forgot a sleeping bag. Whatever. So state parks, it's known state parks actually generate money for the general fund. So in these severe economic times, obviously we're fully cognizant of the fact that really important programs across the board at the state are getting hit big time. But state parks are not only a good economic alternative for families, they're good for your health. They have that that spin-off economic impact in local economies. And so from an economic standpoint, I mean, that we're having to close these state parks because we're taking a share of the burden. Mm-hmm. But really we're hoping that we'll be able to mitigate those closures, and get state parks back to the level of excellence that they should be. As the world-class state park system, that it is.
Mm-hmm. We're just about out of time now, but before we go, I want to get one caller on the line here. Annie from Visalia, you're on Quality of Life. Just a few minutes. Yes, Annie?
Hello.
Yes, go right ahead. We just have a few seconds.
Two comments?
Yes, go ahead.
Closing our parks is like China revolution and destroying its past and its culture. It's a way of controlling people and cutting off the most vital part that a population needs is a source with its past and a source with the land. And this great big fuss over cutting spending is totally ridiculous, because the money that's being wasted at the top levels of government is way past what it would pay to keep parks open and keep Social Security and so forth. The whole issue is being worded wrong and addressed wrong. There's no need to close the parks. So I thank you. I'll go off the air.
All right, Annie. Well, thank you very much for your call today. And that just about does it for our program on state parks and national parks on Quality of Life. We'd like to thank our guests, Jerry Emery, the Communications Director for the California State Parks Foundation, Kathy Weatherman, the Superintendent of the Tehachapi District of the California State Parks Department, which faces closure of two of the state parks that district includes, and also John Rasmussen, the Tehachapi Chapter of the Sierra Club. Thank you all for joining us today on Valley Public Radio. You can continue the discussion online. Email us at talk@kvpr.org. For Marv Allen, Tracy Sharman, Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.